From Kansas to New Jersey, South Dakota to Alabama, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the war on poverty has been a failure. Now, private philanthropy is at work to help lift more Americans to economic self-sufficiency. Evan Feinberg of Stand Together is here with details. President Trump touted his administration's economic success in the State of the Union address. Democrats disagreed. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Republicans in Congress are conflicted over how much power the president should have on trade policy and tariffs. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a closer look. And President Trump's State of the Union address attempted both unity and a restatement of his policies. Did he succeed? Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Back in the 1960s, President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty. Decades later, after spending billions of dollars, the problem persists. The private sector is now trying a new approach to ending poverty. Evan Feinberg is executive director of Stand Together. He is here to talk about those efforts. Evan, welcome to American Radio Journal. Evan, when we talk about the problem of poverty in this country, it's something that the nation has been struggling with. It really took off in terms of government efforts at alleviating poverty back in the 1960s with the war on poverty. Government efforts haven't worked out all that well. So we're going to talk in a couple of minutes about what you are doing from the private sector. But first of all, tell us a little bit about the problem of poverty in America and the cycle that traps generation after generation in poverty.
The problem is really significant. There are 40 million Americans today that are living in poverty, 18 million of which live in persistent poverty, meaning they are just stuck in the cycle. 1.5 million people are chronically jobless, meaning they are not finding meaningful work whatsoever. Another 2.1 million are addicted to opioids. It's affecting a lot of people. And here's the worst part. The rate of social mobility in America is actually on the decline, which means you're becoming more likely to stay poor if you're born poor. A generation ago, 90% of Americans did better than their parents. Today, only 50% do better than their parents. We went from a guarantee to a coin flip in just one generation. The problem is bad, and it's unfortunately getting worse.
Why is it that despite the investment of trillions of taxpayer dollars, government programs aimed at alleviating poverty have not worked?
Certainly, the government's war on poverty has been an abject failure. Frankly, it's spent a lot of money managing the symptoms of the problem and is not really doing anything to help people to transform their lives and get out of poverty. But I think it's important to know that it's not just the government's war on poverty that's the problem. By some estimates, there's as much as $400 billion spent every year in private philanthropy to try to address issues related to poverty, and none of it's working either. I think at the end of the day, what we have is a broken social sector that just treats people as victims in need and focuses on the deficiencies rather than on the aptitudes of all people to contribute, and instead of really focusing on what we could do to help people to lift themselves out of poverty through the right community support, we spend time squabbling with one another and arguing about how different experts are going to solve the problem, and frankly, none of it's working.
Along comes then Stand Together, your organization, and you are taking a different approach. So tell us a bit about your efforts.
If you think about it, what's really needed in a sector that is atrophying, that's not solving these problems, we need disruption. Amazon didn't disrupt the retail space by studying what Macy's had done and delivering resources through evidence-based best practices. They came along and disrupted by having a real focus on what will help people to live better lives. And the same thing needs to happen in the social sector. And so what we're doing to Stand Together is focusing on entrepreneurship, and specifically what we call social entrepreneurship. So we are a platform that invests in social entrepreneurs that have a demonstrated track record of helping people to break the cycle of poverty, of actually transforming their lives and overcoming poverty in a self-sufficient way. And then we help them to do more, which means we need to invest as the way that business investors would, invest in their growth and their scale and their replication and their management practices and how they measure success and in real time fail and improve. That type of investment in entrepreneurship is what's going to be required to sort of overcome the quagmire that we're in.
Let's talk a little bit more, Evan, about these social entrepreneurs. Tell us specifically what sort of activities do they engage in? What sort of projects do they undertake that bring something new to the table here?
In entrepreneurship in general, it's usually when somebody has encountered a problem in their own life, they come up with a solution to solve that problem, and they realize that that solution can help solve the same problem for many more people. And so you take a guy like Scott Strode with the Phoenix, which is a group that we work with at Stand Together. Scott himself was addicted to substances. And through the power of community, he was able to overcome his addiction and stay sober. He started as a guy on a bike. He started riding his bike with other folks in recovery, and it helped him to overcome his addiction. And so he started biking clubs and then running clubs and climbing clubs, and then soon they had a gym. And now the Phoenix has grown to 28 cities across the country where these peer-to-peer physical fitness addiction recovery programs are helping thousands of people each year to sustainably overcome their addiction and lift themselves out of poverty. That's the type of social entrepreneur we're looking for, someone with a creative and innovative solution that is effective. The Phoenix has half the relapse rates of the best clinical programs in the country and has the entrepreneurial spirit to grow that operation to reach many more people.
Now, over the last couple of months, your organization, Stand Together, has announced a number of grants and philanthropic efforts that you've undertaken. Can you fill us in a bit on those?
We launched just 3 years ago in January of 2016 with this belief that there was so much opportunity out there to invest in the social sector and really help millions of people to transform their lives. And we're now realizing that potential. And so this past month in January was Poverty Awareness Month. And we really felt like it was important that the country really spend more time and attention on these critical problems, but also on the solutions most effective in helping to solve it. So we announced a series of investments across each of our portfolios, everything from criminal justice-related organizations to workforce to financial empowerment and housing and homelessness, addiction and mental health. Across each of these portfolios, we made announcements in January. They totaled over $20 million this month, and that's just a fraction of what we'll do at Stand Together this year. And then we also announced an additional $10 million challenge for the over 100 organizations that we work with at Stand Together. We announced that we would match up to $10 million in small dollar donations that individuals make to these organizations, not because we're looking to just to raise another $10 million this year, although those dollars will significantly help these organizations. It's because we want to help thousands and soon millions of Americans to start their journeys as social entrepreneurs themselves, dedicating their lives to helping others to improve their lives.
We have been talking with Evan Feinberg, who is executive director of Stand Together. And Evan, tell us just a little bit more about Stand Together and where folks can go on the web to learn more.
Stand Together is a platform that invests in social entrepreneurs that are capable of helping people to break the cycle of poverty. And so we're a platform for philanthropists to pool their resources and invest in the most effective nonprofits that are out there. So for folks that want to be involved, they can go to our website, standtogetheragainstpoverty.org. That's standtogetheragainstpoverty.org.
Evan Feinberg of Stand Together. Evan, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And now we turn to Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth to find out what's been happening in Congress this past week. Scott, good to have you here. Scott, we had the State of the Union address by President Trump this past week. There was some focus on the economy, more on other issues in that. But let's drill down a little bit more into what is happening with the U.S. economy. The president, of course, is out there touting the fact that we have a lot of new jobs being created. Democrats are claiming that the middle class is being left behind. So what is the actual truth here?
I think that the economy is booming right now. President Trump has pretty much delivered on his promise to boost the economy and usher in sort of a new economic time for the American people. We have 5.3 million jobs that have been created since President Trump was elected. And even last month, the job numbers exceeded expectation with 304,000 new jobs created. That pretty much smashed expectations by almost 150,000 new jobs. At the same time, we're looking at averaging 3% over the last four quarters of economic growth on gross domestic product. And we just see a lot of really good economic indicators in the private economy.
When we look at the job growth that is occurring, Scott, is this job growth across the board, or the Democrats like to say, well, this is benefiting the rich, which of course is what they always say about everything. But the job growth, is it only benefiting those at the upper end of the wage scale, or is it being shared by those at the middle and lower ends and by minorities?
That is a fantastic point, Lohman. Let's talk about the unemployment rate for a lot of these categories that the left always wants to hammer with their identity politics. But the reality is African American, Asian American, Hispanic American, and female unemployment levels are all at record lows. We're at a 50-year low underneath President Trump, and I don't think that it's just impacting the rich. We're seeing pretty good wage growth across the board, and manufacturing industry has added hundreds of thousands of jobs since the election. And so what we're kind of seeing is a rebirth here of some of the traditional sectors and industry across the country. And the tax cuts obviously gets a lot of the attention from the left, but really what they're ignoring is the deregulation that is really allowing jobs to take off.
There is the threat next week of the shutdown resuming. Are there negotiations going on in Congress in an effort to come to an accommodation with President Trump, and particularly his request for demand for funding for a border wall? Or does it look like maybe next week we could be at loggerheads again?
Last week, Nancy Pelosi said during a press conference that there would be no border wall money from the conference committee that's meeting on the immigration deal. President Trump has a number of options at his disposal in order to still find ways to provide funding for a border wall. There are existing parts in statute that allow him to proceed through different buckets in the Pentagon's budget, and then he could also declare a national emergency in order to activate the wall starting out. The issue with the emergency declaration is that it could be tied up for some length of time within the court system, and you know that could be a couple of months, it could be a year and a half. Then it really turns into an emergency situation with more and more people coming over the border as issue continues to percolate within the courts. So we'd like to see it not get tied up in the courts, and we'd like to see some sort of a resolution through actual law. But we do think that the president has the existing authority through current law and statute to proceed with at least some funding toward a new wall. I don't think that there's going to be another government shutdown, but we'll all be watching closely, and we'll see what moves the president decides to make in about a week.
Yeah, we'll find out in the not-too-distant future. Now, meanwhile, in Congress, those on the extreme left in both the House and Senate are proposing this so-called Green New Deal. Can you talk for just a minute about that Green New Deal, Scott? And this would be a radical transformation of the U.S. economy, would it not?
It would, Lohman. So what you have here is Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts joining with the new sweetheart of the left, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in introducing a resolution. It's a non-binding resolution, but it's still sort of a wish list of green policy from the radical left. And so they have a resolution called the Green New Deal. Nancy Pelosi has called it the Green Dream. And what it would do is it would eliminate all carbon emissions within 10 years, totally transforming the U.S. economy related to electricity generation, our transportation policy, agriculture. And its aim is to create new jobs and boost the economy. But we saw what happened with Solyndra a few years ago. In the reality, it would totally destroy the U.S. economy and really set us back if something like this was to go forward. We think that it is just a messaging document from the left to appease the movement that has propelled Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to the front and center of her party. In many ways, she is the leader of the Democratic Party because they don't have a strong leader like President Trump. And so what you're seeing is sort of an internal battle between people like AOC and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the traditional older leadership. So it's really coming to the forefront here. And resolution that they've introduced this week is really, I think, just concerning, because even though it allows for a transformation over 10 years, that would be very drastic to everything that the United States has been able to accomplish to be the leading economy within the world.
Not to mention completely unrealistic, but we'll delve a bit more into that. Yeah, we'll have to parse this a little bit more in a future segment. But for right now, we have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, we'd like you to tell us a little bit about the club and where folks can go on the internet to read more.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And if your listeners are interested, they can go to our website, www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can actually join as a member of the Club for Growth for free.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, talk with you next week.
Thank you, Loman.
Republicans in Congress have introduced conflicting bills when it comes to the president's authority over trade policy. For details, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
For the first 2 years of President Donald Trump's time in office, his administration has really been the sole driver of federal trade policy, whether that means setting tariffs on imports or negotiating trade deals like the rewrite of NAFTA that the administration announced last year. Trump has been the one doing things, and Congress has mostly been content to just stand by and watch it happen, with a few performative grumbles here and there. But now, for a variety of reasons, Congress is set to play a bigger role on the trade front, whether it wants to or not. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at a couple of competing trade proposals in front of Congress, one of which got a big shout out on Tuesday night at President Donald Trump's State of the Union address. Now, as I said, Congress is going to be playing a bigger role on the trade front in 2019, and doing so could expose a deep divide within the Republican Party, where one faction is currently engaged in a process that's trying to claw back some congressional control over the trade policy that the Trump administration is setting, while there's another group of Republican lawmakers that are ready to hand yet more authority to the chief executive to write the rules for how America participates in the global economy. And it was the latter of those two things, of course, that President Trump was asking for in Tuesday's State of the Union address, calling specifically for Congress to pass the United States Reciprocal Trade Act. The bill would effectively give presidents more opportunities to raise trade barriers and impose tariffs as a means of gaining leverage against countries that are trading with the United States. For example, the European Union currently charges a 10% tariff on cars imported from America, but America charges only a 2.5% tariff on car imports from Europe. So if the Reciprocal Trade Act were to become law, Trump could effectively circumvent Congress and raise car tariffs up to 10%, something that he's already threatened to do via a different trade mechanism, and something that American carmakers and car dealers say would be problematic for them and would probably raise prices for consumers. The bill has some other shortcomings, too. Critics say that it would grant too much authority to the president to respond to tariffs imposed by other countries without setting any sort of limitations on exactly how high those foreign tariffs must be before the president's authority would kick in. So it would effectively give Trump and future presidents a blank check to crank up protectionism if they wanted to. And indeed, Trump has already taken advantage of some of these vaguely written rules that are on the books. For example, Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 gives presidents the authority to impose tariffs for national security purposes, but it doesn't really define what counts as a matter of national security. Trump has used Section 232 to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, including imports from close U.S. allies like Canada and Europe, under the rationale that national security is served by increasing the price of imported metals and protecting domestic suppliers of steel and aluminum. Restricting Trump's ability to continue using Section 232 in that way is the aim of the other Republican-backed trade bill that's now circulating in Congress. As I detailed last week at Reason.com, a bipartisan group of lawmakers from the House and Senate have joined together to sponsor the bicameral Congressional Trade Authority Act, which would give Congress the ability to block future Section 232 tariff proposals and would limit the definition of national security that gives presidents the opportunity to impose those tariffs in the first place. The two dueling bills are really a telling representation of where the Republican Party sits right now with the question of free trade. Aside from the R that appears next to their name when they're speaking on CNN or C-SPAN, there's really very little overlap between the 18 Republicans who have sponsored Trump's Reciprocal Trade Act and the free traders within the Republican Party, like Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, who have backed the bicameral Congressional Trade Authority Act. Now, there are, of course, plenty of other internal policy disagreements within the Republican Party on everything from fiscal policy to immigration, from entitlement reform to foreign interventions. You can find a variety of positions because, after all, there's a lot of people that call themselves Republicans. But on trade, the Republicans are faced with a difference of kind and not one of degree. What I mean by that is that there's effectively no middle ground to be had between those who want to give the president greater power to levy tariffs and raise trade barriers and those who want to claw back some of that authority that he already has. Nor could there really be a middle ground between those two positions because they're not merely opposite policy prescriptions, but they're really based on diametrically opposed views about how power in Washington ought to be shared. And this deep division within the Republican Party is not something that the party will be able to ignore a whole lot longer. In fact, it's likely to come to a head this year, not so much over the tariff bills themselves, but over an upcoming debate about ratifying the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. That's the deal that the Trump administration struck last year that is supposed to replace NAFTA. Even though Trump often talks about the USMCA as if it's a done deal, it still has to be approved by Congress before it officially goes into effect, and its chances to pass have already been somewhat complicated by the Democrats' takeover of the House. It probably would have been easier to get the deal through Congress last year when Republicans controlled everything. But there's, even now, not an indication that all Republicans are on board with the USMCA. Toomey, for example, is on the record as being a no vote unless changes are made to do away with some of the more protectionist elements in the proposal, like the stringent barriers for importing automobiles from Mexico. Whichever trade bill emerges victorious is likely to be attached to the USMCA in some way, shape, or form, assuming that the trade deal manages to get through Congress itself. And if either of those two bills, those two tariff bills, are going to pass this year, one half of the Republican Party is going to have to emerge victorious over the other because, again, there's not a whole lot of room for compromise when the two ideas on the table are give the president more power and take away some of the president's power that he already has. Asked Wednesday what it would take for pro-trade Republicans to support Trump's call for the passage of the Reciprocal Trade Act, Senator Ron Johnson was trying to find that middle ground. He told me that he would like to see future trade deals approved by Congress. But when another reporter pointed out that the bill Trump once passed seems designed specifically to circumvent Congress, Johnson paused for a second and then said, "Well, I think I'd have a problem with that." For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of these bills. You can check out our coverage of the State of the Union address and everything else that we're working on up at Reason.com. And I'll be right back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
President Trump called for national unity in his State of the Union address, but not at the expense of getting his border wall. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has this American Radio Journal commentary.
The State of the Union is divided. As divided as I've ever seen it. I was invited to participate in a conference call with about 500 opinion leaders the day before the President's State of the Union speech, led by his communications team. We were told that the principal theme would be an appeal to come together in a unifying spirit of bipartisanship. How well did he do? On this matter of appealing to unity, the speech had two distinctly different parts, an early call for unity and a later articulation of his positions on a handful of issues that amounted to poking his opponents in their eyes with a stick. Here are some excerpts from the first part. "I stand here ready to work with you to achieve historic breakthroughs for all Americans. Millions of our fellow citizens are watching us gathered in this great chamber, hoping we will govern not as two parties but as one nation. The agenda I will lay out this evening is not a Republican agenda or a Democrat agenda. It is the agenda of the American people. Now, those excerpts are the product of professional speechwriters, and they express a wholesome, unifying theme. However, the later part of the speech was anything but unifying. President Trump left his presidential tone behind and went into the campaign mode that he so relishes. The problem is that in a campaign, especially a big Trump campaign rally, the candidate is usually speaking to his supporters. So powerful, even provocative formulations of his positions are exactly what the audience wants to hear. In a divided Congress, however, with a new speaker and her new majority, those provocative formulations are not what the audience wants to hear. I applaud the clarity and validity of his remarks opposing and highlighting the horrors of late-term abortions, championed by two Democratic Party leaders just within the last week and many progressive members of their party, but I don't think it was wise to do so in the context of a State of the Union speech to a joint session of a divided Congress. Immigration was also high on his policy agenda. I made a bet with myself that he'd figure out a way to talk about immigration and the need to fund construction of some kind of secure barrier without ever saying the word wall. I had come to the conclusion that the only way that this stubborn man could come to a funding agreement with the equally stubborn speaker and thus avoid another government shutdown was to propose a wall that's not a wall, at least to Nancy Pelosi. Was I ever wrong about that? President Trump pounded away on the wall repeatedly. I doubt that he made any more converts on the wall than he did on abortion. The oddest line in the speech stood out, even from both the unifying part and the more strident part, however. That's when he said, at the end of his unity pitch, "An economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations. If there is going to be peace in legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just does not work that way." What does that even mean? Economic prosperity and investigations are almost entirely unrelated. How does an investigation, even one that is, to borrow the president's word, a ridiculous partisan investigation, threaten a strong economy? Maybe if there's a high degree of likelihood that it would lead to impeachment, but even if it did, Mike Pence has a very similar philosophy on economics to President Trump. Students of logic or Latin would call this statement of his a non sequitur. Those words are almost certainly not the product of the president's speechwriters. They're his own, and they give us a better insight to his true mental framework than the speechwriter's words of unity. Yes, the State of the Union is divided, and despite the attempt to make the speech a call to unity, there's little evidence of a real change. Round one of the shutdown battle went to Nancy Pelosi. Why would she even consider a change in strategy for round two? This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include our newest affiliates, KIRC-FM, KSLE-FM, and KWSH-AM in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Welcome to our new listeners in the Sooner State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some of the interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.